like to start with Blue Cliff Record Case 27, Yunmen's complete exposure. A monk asked Yunmen, "What is it when the tree withers and the leaves fall?" He answered, "Complete exposure of the golden wind." The golden wind is refers to the autumn wind, perhaps with the golden leaves all in it, and a late autumn wind, it's cold. The monk is asking this sincere question that comes up for all of us, I'm sure, about old age, sickness, and death. How is this? What is it? Thinking about the answer, the complete exposure to the golden wind, as I was sitting outside of Dunkin' Donuts tonight, having my dinner out on the bench, there was a row of cherry trees that were blooming, and every time the wind stirred, there'd be this flutter of blossoms falling off of the trees. It was a pink wind, and even though it's spring, and these were the blossoms on the tree, and it was filled with them, there was still this feeling as the wind blew them around that already this was coming to an end, this spring of the cherry blossoms anyway. This fleeting moment, the sense of how quickly things pass, and so the monk asks about this. What is it when all of it has passed? When everything that we had gathered up finally withers and drops? And it put me in mind of a question that I had when I was in college. And I'd always been interested in biology, and so I was a biology major. And part of what drew me to that was that, well, it was a study of life, and life was the big question, right? What is this? What's going on here? And so I thought perhaps, somehow in the back of my mind, I thought that if I studied enough biology, I would begin to get a glimpse into what made it all work. that didn't seem to pan out. And so I took... I thought maybe I needed to focus in more tightly. You know? So first it was microbiology, you know, really get down into the fine points of it, down into the molecular level. But it turned out that that things went even deeper than that, and that maybe submolecular into the atomic level. And so I took some physics classes. I wasn't very good at them, but I took them relativity, and this only led to the realization that one could go even deeper than that into subatomic particles, and so I took a class that dealt with muons and all these things that if you crash one atom into another, it creates all these strange particles. And, you know, still thinking that somehow I would get to the bottom of all this if I just looked closely enough. But the subatomic particles thing sort of turned into mathematics. You know, there was a point where you just couldn't describe it any other way. And it was a very unsatisfying experience. Mm-hmm. I'd gone all that way and really came up with no answer. It was outside of what I could think about. The sphere of that analytical thought, that whole scientific method, was just not a big enough sphere. It didn't encompass everything that needed to be encompassed in order to answer that question. And so this brings us to Walter Gröning, I read an article about him this week. He died. He was the world's oldest man at 114. And when he had turned 100, he was interviewed. And of course, the obvious question was, what are the secrets to your longevity? And having lived for 100 years at that point, he had a few opinions. First on his list was embrace change, even when the change slaps you in the face. Every change is good. And that really struck me. I mean, that sounds like much that we hear about every day is a good day turning toward rather than away from. And I especially liked the way he framed it such that, and I heard the same thing in the koan, the case that I began the talk with, that there's the one way of looking at it, which is embracing the change, turning toward, and that's kind of this pure motive. And we, at least I, always say, oh yeah, I can do that. Yeah, of course, that's the way to go. You know, and you charge out of Sesshin with that good intention, having practiced in that direction for you know however many days, and then. You know, you run into the St. Patrick's Day parade and it slaps you in the face, you know, and you're confronted with the reality of what that really feels like in your life. And for me, I'm always sure that somehow I've run into the exception to the rule, that this is the one that's just not fair, you know, and this is not the one that anyone could be expected to embrace. But of course, that's exactly the category that they all are. That was Walter's suggestion to us. So with these two stories in mind, I was diligently preparing my talk for you both, for you all last night, and at the same time, of course, checking in on Facebook now and again. Somebody had posted a link to a video of the tsunami in Japan. And I had seen, you know, some photos and some videos, but this was one that had not come upon before. And it was different, really, really struck me differently than the others, which were, you know, tragic and one feels so deeply for these people. But this was somehow much more personal. It was a group of Japanese people, one who had a camcorder or whatever, some digital recorder, and they had fled out of one of the coastal towns up onto a rise where they felt they would be safe. They were maybe 5 miles inland, I'm judging from the video, and the video was about 6 minutes long. And this was the time that it took for the first wave of the tsunami to go from the coast into where they were. So it began with just this sort of distant line of dust and what have you that was being raised by, you couldn't even see what. And the town was still intact there. Mm-hmm. And there was a group of people with this videographer. And they were all sort of talking amongst themselves. You know, it was an exciting thing, I guess. They felt they were safe and, you know, there were going to be some waves, but I don't, you know, who would have known what the magnitude would be? But this wave relentlessly came forward. You could just see the advancing line and things beginning to be lifted up. And as it came closer, whole buildings just crumbling over. And the tenor of the talk, which was Japanese, I don't know what they were saying, but you didn't need to, began to change. And there were some cries and wailing and you know, as people began to realize just what the enormity of this was. And the wave finally reached the very edge of town. And it was enormous. It's just incredible to see. And you know, these like industrial-sized roofs just floating along and crashing into everything, and you know, zillions of cars and what have you. And as it reached the edge of town, His little fingers began running across the vacant lot between the edge of the town and the rise where the videographer was. Maybe four or five people racing across, trying to beat the wave. And you could see what their rate of progress was, and you could see what the rate of the progress of the wave was. And you knew how it was going to end for them. The videographer shifted the camera before it reached that point. And so we can't help but ask ourselves about what is the justice of this? What is the fairness of it? And again, it's in that sphere of things that we can only think about, and it's not a big enough sphere to really understand. The thinking won't get us there. All that we can do is what we learn to do here as we sit in a case like this. I mean, sometimes there are things we can do if it's something that's close to us. But there's so much that we can't. The world is such a burning place. And so we learn to how to not turn away from it, but to bear witness, even if it's through a video. And this makes it very personal. And as we sit with the feelings that come up from this, the thoughts first, the whys and the various questions, see them arise, allow them to come forth, and then the feelings that come with them of sorrow and fear. Whatever else, allowing that to happen too. And for me, there's always this sense that it's going to be too much to bear, that somehow my heart can't hold it and that it will explode, somehow it will burst, whatever that means. If I'm able to even turn toward that and say, yes, burst, and perhaps this is your experience too, it never does. Somehow it can hold whatever is brought forth. And not only that, but there becomes this recognition that it's not just my sorrow, it's not just my fear. There's something universal about it. It's reaching into a pool that is connected with all of us everywhere. That in some very fundamental way, we're not separate units, discrete from one another. That we can feel another person's sorrow because we reach into that same pool. So, this brought up for me the story, the legend of Avalokiteshvara, also known as Kanon or Kanzeon, depending on which country, which language. All of them referring to the Bodhisattva of compassion. And this is a way of embodying that which is formless. Just as when we bow, we are embodying or manifesting gratitude or humility or respect. In the same way, or as when we sit in zazen, we are embodying this formlessness that is Buddha nature. Bringing it forth, realizing it. And so this image, Avalokiteshvara, is the embodiment of compassion. And there's a story that goes with it. At least this is how I know the story. I guess there are several versions. And that is that Avalokiteshvara took a vow to save all beings from suffering and vowed to work long and hard, however long it took, in order to accomplish this. And so, you know, however one might go about doing this, Avalokiteshvara began and worked and worked. And I have the image in my mind of somebody juggling more and more balls. You know, they're coming in and just sort of frantically trying to keep more and more of them going up in the air. Don't let any of them fall. You know, and if you really concentrate and don't stop for a minute, you can manage to keep them all going. But sooner or later, you're going to screw up, you know, and the ball's going to fall. And when that happens, they just all start falling. And sure enough, that's what happened with Avalokiteshvara, that for a while it seemed like this grand goal was going to be accomplished and that everybody could be saved from suffering. And then it began to all fall apart. It's like, you know, when our lives are going so very well and we figure, you know, if we can just you know, get to that next promotion, be able to pay the mortgage more comfortably, and the kids can go to, you know, nicer school or, you know, whatever. And, you know, if all the plans just work out, then we can be happy. And then something falls through and the whole thing crumbles. And so we can feel for Avalokiteshvara when this happened. In fact, it was, you know, such a on such a global scale that when the failure came, Avalokiteshvara's head exploded. I kind of felt that way sometimes. And in its place, there are various ways of telling this, but anyway, in the place of that head were 11 or some larger number of faces that could witness all these sorrows and sufferings and joys, witness all that goes on in this world. And also there were many arms, and the hands all had eyes in the palms for seeing what needed to be done and being able to do it. And I particularly like that image because it doesn't involve, you know, thinking about it. It's just seeing and responding. And so, of course, one thing that struck me about this is that when I think of compassion, I think of the heart. And that wasn't really even mentioned in the legend. But then I think really what it is all of Avalokiteshvara is the heart. The hands with the eyes is the heart responding, and the many faces that witness is the heart responding. So that's my take on it. So there's some transformation that takes place. Just probably not 11 faces, but when we allow our heart to break, to explode like that, something changes, and it's not something that we could anticipate or make happen otherwise, but it allows us to enter more fully into our life and connect more deeply with everyone and everything in it. And I came upon a passage from Rilke that speaks to this. He says, "So you mustn't be frightened if a sadness rises in front of you, larger than any you have ever seen, if an anxiety like light and cloud shadows moves over your hands and over everything you do. You must realize that something is happening to you, that life has not forgotten you, that it holds you in its hand and will not let you fall. Why do you want to shut out of your life any uneasiness, any misery, any depression, since after all, you don't know what work these conditions are doing inside you? This complete exposure of the golden wind, this turning toward, not trying to hide behind anything, utterly vulnerable. We don't know what work this will do. But when that last leaf is stripped off of the tree, it does allow the sunlight to reach the ground where before there was shade, and perhaps something new and green comes up there. I'll leave it with this. Thank you. So as always, any comments or questions or observations are welcome, or we can sit quietly.
As Kate said so beautifully in that talk, all of those layers and all of those ways of looking at it are completely on the wrong scale to take it in, which doesn't mean there's not some truth there. It's like a bottle in the center of the ocean. You know, trying to scoop up the ocean. It's got some water in it. But this bottle, no bottle is the right one to contain this much greater truth.
Yeah, and going back to your first comment, I guess they kind of go together, but it always astonishes me how, for myself at any rate, I really have to be backed against the wall before I will turn and have that, feel that complete exposure, you know, make myself vulnerable. It really has to be a dark road in order for Kanon to come forth. I hope it's not like that for everybody. But maybe it is, and maybe it has to be that way. It's also something kind of wonderful about that. Yeah. Thank
you. I appreciate the seasonal aspect or metaphor that is allowed, but like complete exposure keeps coming around again.
Yeah.
And
layers, yeah. And it's never the same spring and fall. It's another one and another. Yeah, it's a little different each time. Kind of like the spiral that we describe practice as you come back again and again, maybe to the same issues, the same questions, but you're coming from a slightly different perspective each time. Mm. Yeah.
And it's never comfortable when that no matter how many times you have been completely exposed, and your heart explodes, or perhaps first gets crushed down like a black hole until it supernovas out. it's never not a painful process. And in a way, one of my other teachers said once that it's always excruciating when the Dharma moves into a new place in your life, which is kind of the sequential pain of the crushed and exploding heart. And then when our heart does explode, part of what goes is this false membrane keeping everything out, and we put so much energy into maintaining this membrane, which is just destined to fail. And then when we can't, there's complete exposure of ourselves to the world to our heart. And there is a different kind of okayness or capacity to be with that kind of post-exploded thing that comes, or that world that we can't keep out.
There's some understanding that this dark place is not all there is, right? It's not as though I feel completely lost there. You know, it still hurts a lot, but there's some understanding that there's a bigger thing going on, that there's a connection to the outside. And even if you lose that a little bit, and I never lose it completely. That's my experience. The practice has really given me some sort of framework for dealing with these things.
I think maybe I'm not as fortunate as you. Because I do lose sight of it, and there are dark places.
It's a funny thing. I mean, you could lose sight of it, but look. You know, you could, on one level, you're completely, you're absolutely busted. But on another level, back of your mind, there's something going on. That's for me.
Well, I see what you mean, and I'm particularly thinking of a time when I was really angry about something. It was about the movers. They didn't come, and my house was packed up and ready, and I'd been calling them, and they said, yeah, we'll be there. We're just a little late, and like hours later, they finally said, well, you know what? We're not going to come. Oh, we'll come tomorrow. And so when tomorrow came, it was the same thing all over again, you know, calling, 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 how come you aren't here? Oh, we'll come, oh, you know what? We don't have the crew, we're not gonna be able to move you. And I was just furious. Well, am I gonna take care of, I've gotta get all this out, you know? And in the middle of all that blind fury, there was this little something that said, you don't have to do that. There's a choice here. And it was absolutely true. And the choice I made was to be furious. Because it just felt good, you know, for that one moment. It was righteous anger, you know. I deserve to be angry, to be right, and they're wrong, and you know, my anger is correct. But so if that's what you mean, then
it
yeah.
Is.
Yeah.
I would say if you hadn't done any work on the cushion, that little voice, you wouldn't have noticed. That's my guess.
So I would agree with all of what you said, and I would add sometimes.
Yeah.
And you're pointing to an important quality here, which is that this path is not nothing, that this practice of refuge in things as they in fact are is real and is reliable, and in a way it's the only thing that you can rely on. And there's a way in which the more we actually do literally practice in the batting cage or piece of music kind of sense of the word practice, the more we practice turning towards and taking refuge in this reality as it in fact is, that we are enhancing our capacity and building a skill that enables us to apply it in more and more challenging circumstances. And even so, And even though it's true that within darkness there is light, within this excruciatingness there is a okayness that holds it, you can't always see it, and sometimes all you've got is the excruciation. And then when you really fail into that, then it kind of opens. But when you can't do anything, all you can do is suffer. And and that's it too. Exposed completely.
Oh, I think you were first. Did you still have a question? Avalokiteshvara.
And my first year was practicing in New Orleans, and
multifaceted, being, like, witnessing the suffering, you know, made me, I felt like it relates to that. And here, Boston teaching, before the break, I was taking some of my students who play soccer and taking them to get some food, and one of them was telling me about some of his friends who had been killed. And I get out of that, and I just, I guess there's so many different levels, you know. Like there's one level where you resonate, you know, feel this vibration, you understand. I think that there's something they share here, and this is something that's like a terrible pain. And then there's another level, maybe this is something like being in the ocean, bottom not being big enough. But, also an appreciation, like, to my case, to that student for, like, including me in this, this kind of, and this promise. Not, you know, not knowing that there isn't really anything to say. To the student. And actually, like, over here, I was thinking of one of my students, and, like, this thing that he had suffered, his jaw was locked, and it had been broken. Sometimes it feels like it's not enough. And I would like to do more.
Yeah, and this the thank you for that. Recognition that what I can do is help with reading, help in this way that I can. That is a great example of what Kate said, the image of Avalokiteshvara's thousand hands and eyes. That is one hand and eye reaching out, seeing and responding. In the presentation of the 16 Bodhisattva precepts in our school, the second pure precept to do good, the first pure precept is to cease evil, cease harm. And we do this by not knowing and giving up fixed ideas about ourselves and the universe. The second pure precept is to do good, which we do by bearing witness to the joys and suffering of the world. This bearing witness is as clearly there and clearly here. It is the thing. And it's not enough. And even in its not enoughness, and without taking away the not enoughness, it is the whole thing. It is the whole inclusive thing. And this is how we actually, and Avalokiteshvara, and all of us who take the Bodhisattva vows, as we will at the end of the night here, is we do save all beings throughout space and time, even with our only ever not enough gestures.
Did you want to go on?
So when I hear about turning toward, I think, if only I could turn toward. So the sutra that came up for me, or the line, was it can't be turned toward or away from. So
I've often wondered about that line myself, you know, and I figure there's turning toward and there's turning toward, you know, like there's the kind where you're actively going toward something, you know, that's the turning toward that doesn't work out so well. And then there's the one that's like not turning away, allowing yourself to see, allowing yourself to witness, and you have to turn in the right direction to be able to do that. And to me, there is indeed a sort of palpable difference about it. And, you know, it happens somewhere down in. There's a shift. I'm sure you've felt this yourself, where you're no longer resisting. Maybe that's what it is. And there's an openness now. Let it come. It's that feeling that you're willing to have the complete exposure. Mm-hmm. You're participating in it.
It's like you don't have to turn towards something, you just have to open to what happens to be in front of you. Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah. Even if what's in front of you is your inability to turn towards something. And I want to really affirm what you expressed so nicely there. It's always a both and in this practice of Zen, and in a way, what you're pointing to is the different realms of the relative and the absolute. In the relative world, there is something that is turning towards, and there is something that is not turning towards. And in this realm of the absolute, which is what we in an important way touch in our Shikhan Plaza, when we see that even such impulses as turning towards are just mental formations arising, even those too, even turning toward is a bottle that is way too small and way too not relevant to the ocean, and that both of those are true, and honoring the truth of both of them in different circumstances is what this practice is. And you're also pointing in the same way to the same thing that we heard in this story of this little thing that we can do is not enough, and it's enough. And this turning toward that we can't turn toward is it.
There's something in
There's no running away from it, I guess.
Well, it's kind of like what Jeff was saying about the cyclic. I think there is running away from it, kind of, until finally there isn't, but actually...
Well, there's trying.
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Huh?
And, you know, in a way, I feel that there's a big invisible neon sign above the doorway to every Zendo that says, run if you can. If there is anything else that is going to work for you, you should do that because that'll be easier. But when that fails, this is the thing you can do.
Thank you all.